From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Justice Brett Kavanaugh will begin hearing cases before the U.S. Supreme Court tomorrow. There was a short swearing-in on Saturday, but a full ceremony has been planned by the White House for later today. The intensely political and very emotional story of Kavanaugh's nomination and confirmation has been written for now, but that rest of the story, as they say, the impact, the ripple effects, I think all of that will continue to be written long past any of our lifetimes. So joining me with more perspective today, as he does nearly every day, is the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Hello, Ken.
As he does every day? Boy, I would love to be on your show every day. You mean every Monday?
Every Monday.
But my goodness, if we were on the show, if I was on your show every day, we would still have tons to talk about. You talk about the repercussions of the Supreme Court fight. You know, we're still fighting the Bork nomination. We're still fighting the Clarence Thomas nomination. Those battles have not gone away at all, and I'm sure this battle, this very ugly and personal battle we heard over Brett Kavanaugh, is not going to disappear anytime soon either.
We're in a bit of a gap, I think. It's a sort of post-adrenaline time. There's some relief and recovery for some people. There is talk about how to undo what's been done for others. And there's this sense of what's next. And I think that's going on coast to coast, don't you?
Well, yes, it is going on coast to coast, but I don't think this is post-adrenaline because I think that the people, the partisans who still have a lot at stake in this battle, which did not end in the 50-48 vote on Kavanaugh, I think they don't want to undo anything. Lindsey Graham, one of the Republicans, one of the more angry Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee, said he's really furious and he intends to go around the country campaigning against Democratic incumbent senators that he calls his friends. So there, and then both sides, Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, are raising money in the aftermath of Kavanaugh. These raw feelings, these hurt feelings, these angry feelings haven't gone away. I don't think the adrenaline has gone away, and maybe we're going to have it every day, at least for the next 29 days until the election.
So the president is planning this celebration for later today. Let's talk for a moment about the impact on President Trump, on his support, on his ranking in the country. What do you think it did for him as a president?
Well, I don't know if anybody's minds are changed. I think the president's approval numbers are still around the low 40s. I don't think that has changed. As far as his legacy goes, I think it's a tremendous victory. Look, the fact is, I mean, you don't need me to point this out, but not only did he not win the popular vote, but he also has two Supreme Court justices to his credit. And of course, when we talk about presidential legacies, a Supreme Court nominee could be, you know, more important than anything else a president does. So I don't know what it does about his personal popularity. I mean, the Republicans still love him. I think it's been interesting that all this happened when Trump, for the most part, has been pretty quiet, except for that poor taste, a mocking of Christine Blasey Ford we saw at a rally the other day. But for the most part, he has stayed low. Mitch McConnell and the other Republicans have done the hard work. But as far as his legacy, as far as what he's gotten accomplished, Donald Trump, promised in 2016 that he would appoint conservative pro-life judges to the Supreme Court. And less than two years in, he has two court nominees on the court.
So there's a lot of discussion today, Ken, about how quickly the conservative tone shows up in the court. One of the ways that this is reflected is by which cases the Supreme Court decides to take. And I want to take you back to an issue that you and I discussed quite intensely, emotionally, along with the rest of the country, and that is gun control. So with Justice Brett Kavanaugh on the court and that movement toward a more conservative tone, which is being expected, what about gun control cases and cases that the court might have said no to in the past?
Well, you know something, I don't see it. I've been reading a lot of articles of what the court may take up in its current term. The only thing I keep reading about is about the dusky gopher frog. Now, I know Beth, you and I have talked about the dusky gopher frog for a long time now. I think
well, that was the very first case that the court started to hear last week.
Well, I never heard of the dusky gopher frog until now. Obviously, that's about the environment, and I make fun of it. But this is part of look. Let's be honest here. Brett Kavanaugh is not replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He's replacing Anthony Kennedy, who is still pretty conservative. So I don't think Kavanaugh's views on guns are going to be far more to the right than Kennedy's were. Of course, Kennedy did cast some key votes for affirmative action and same-sex marriage and even abortion rights, all of which liberals say are in jeopardy with Kavanaugh on the court. But I don't see anything really dramatic, and I have a feeling that John Roberts, who even though the Chief Justice, who even though he is a conservative, cares about the role of the Supreme Court, the history of the Supreme Court. I think he would be very happy if the court didn't take up any controversial case right now. I think he wants things to simmer down a little bit. So if all we have is dusky gopher frogs and maybe some other things on the environment or minor things, that would be very happy for John Roberts, because he knows that the feelings are very raw. And I mean, we're already talking about impeaching Brett Kavanaugh, and he's been on the court. Well, you know, he gets sworn in tomorrow. So I don't think you can impeach him until you have him on the court. And some Democrats are not even willing to wait that long.
Well, he had that swearing in ceremony Saturday. So I guess technically he was sworn in.
And then he joins the court. Right, exactly.
Tomorrow.
And for the record, you're not going to look, the history of impeaching Supreme Court justice, it happened once in 1804 with a Supreme Court justice, and he wasn't removed from the court because the Senate couldn't muster the 2/3 majority. My point is that he is not going to be impeached, just like Donald Trump is not going to be impeached. And certainly nobody's going to be impeached unless the Democrats win both houses of Congress. And right now, with 29 days to go, I'm not convinced the Democrats win the Senate at all. Matter of fact, they could even lose seats in the Senate.
And Ken, we talked on this program last week about Justice Samuel Chase. So that's another piece of Supreme Court history.
That's the guy, 1804. Right. I was just a kid.
California Senators Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris, we talked about them on this program. They were a no vote. Let's spend a moment on Nevada Senator Dean Heller. He's a Republican. He voted yes, but he's a Republican who is vulnerable, perhaps the most so in the country.
Well, I don't know if he's the most vulnerable in the country. I think that honor goes to Heidi Heitkamp, the Democrat from North Dakota. But
right.
I do agree that he's the most vulnerable Republican incumbent, given the fact that he's the only Republican running this year, a Senator Republican this year, in a state carried by Hillary Clinton, and that was in Nevada. So he's running, and plus the fact that he voted yes on Kavanaugh, and his opponent is a Democratic female, Congresswoman Rosen of Nevada. And the last poll I saw, maybe 2 weeks ago, had Heller at 46, Rosen at 43. So given the fact that unions are very strong in Nevada, given the fact that Hillary Clinton carried the state, and given the fact that women are thought to be mobilizing against Heller because of the Kavanaugh vote, but because of others as well, I don't know. Look, I think if he voted no on it, I think the conservatives and the Republicans could have been so furious with him that they wouldn't have come out in November. Either way, it was a tough vote for him, just like it was a tough vote for Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, who voted no. That could end Heidi Heitkamp's career. I don't know if this yes vote ends Heller's career, but he is in a tough fight with Jackie Rosen.
Right. You're listening to the political junkie, Ken Rudin. At any point over the last number of days, Ken, you and I would have had a much different conversation as this nomination and confirmation process went. It was a different story every day. I do want to share some of the California reaction. Governor Brown issued a statement once the confirmation was official, saying this controversial and partisan choice further deepens the divisions in America and profoundly undermines democratic governance, a real tragedy. Regardless of his opinion, he is highlighting what everybody on both sides of the aisle is talking about, and that is the division in America on display and the intensity of that going into midterms. Take it from there, Ken.
You know, that's absolutely true. And look, look, I can understand why liberals feel and people who believe in women's reproductive rights are alarmed by Kavanaugh on the court because, look, Donald Trump said he's going to only appoint pro-life judges. So I think we know where Brett Kavanaugh comes down on this. But I think the reason this really hurt even more, was more intense, was because it wasn't only ideology. It was about honesty. It was about temperament. It was about blind politics. I mean, when you heard Kavanaugh attack the Clintons and the left wingers, and you know, those who were upset that Trump won in 2016. That's not what Supreme Court nominees are supposed to be doing. You don't make personal attacks against Democrats or Republicans, either one, and you don't make it about politics. I know that John Roberts was upset by this, but basically we just saw a 2-3 week spectacle that I don't think these raw feelings are going away anytime soon. So yes, the Senate was split in half, basically in half, 50-48. I think the country was split in half. And I don't think it's going away anytime soon. And again, if you think of Bork, you think of Clarence Thomas, you think of other battles, Bush versus Gore, you know, a lot of that was on party politics and party preferences. But the fact that this got personal, basically a woman came forward to talk about sexual assault, that, I mean, when Susan Collins stood up in the Senate and said, and this is Susan Collins, is known to be a proponent of women's rights, and to say, well, I believe that something happened to her, but I think she's, you know, I don't believe what she said it had anything to do with Brett Kavanaugh. That hurts, and that affects people, and then women heard that message. So I suspect that I suspect that both parties are going to be energized by what happened in these hearings. Women who really, you know, feel that their message was ignored are going to come out heavily on November 6th. And I think conservatives who feel that the left wing was trying to derail Kavanaugh and take away the choice of the president, I think Republicans are energized as well. So, I mean, I don't like the fact that there's so much anger in this country, and there is. I do hope that people will come out and vote and make their point, might make their views known. But there is a raw, angry feeling, as we saw with Lindsey Graham saying, "I'm going to campaign against all these Democrats because I hate what they did." Just, you know, the fact that the vote is finished and Kavanaugh's on the court doesn't end the raw partisan feelings that we're going to have that will go well beyond what happens in November.
So let me share. I picked two California members of Congress, one from each party. Congressman Tom McClintock's statement read in part, "This is a momentous and joyous day for the Constitution and for the rule of law. Justice Kavanaugh's record of upholding and defending the Constitution as written, whatever the political implications, will be a welcome addition to the Supreme Court. Hopefully, this will be a turning point, not only for the Supreme Court, but for the entire nation." So there are many Republicans who are going to echo that sentiment as strongly as on the other side. Here's Doris Matsui, part of her statement, saying, "I am concerned that this confirmation process will have a chilling effect on survivors of sexual assault coming forward. Furthermore, I believe Judge Kavanaugh's temperament throughout his testimony raises questions about his ability to be an impartial justice." She writes, "The American people deserve a better confirmation process and a better Supreme Court justice."
You know something? Those two opinions, those two things that we heard from McClintock and Matsui, are exactly the split we're hearing in the country.
Right.
Republicans are elated, Democrats are fearful. And, you know, for all the time in the 1960s and 70s, when conservatives were so upset about the liberal Earl Warren Supreme Court and that the fact that it was going so far in the left-wing direction, that's exactly how liberals feel now with a court that has gotten even much more conservative with Kavanaugh replacing Kennedy. And, of course, if there's another vacancy in the near future, let's just say Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that would make the Kavanaugh fight look like a tea party. I mean, a tea party, in the fact that if you replace a liberal with a Trump nominee, then it's going to be World War III. And so as bitterly divisive as it is, as we heard in the Matsui and McClintock opinions, I still think that the next battle, I mean, I can't believe I'm looking forward to the next battle already, but I think the next battle is going to be even worse and far uglier.
It would be tempting right now to talk about the midterm elections. I think I want to let a week go by and pick this up next week when maybe we get some polling information. Maybe we see what happens in our country between now and then. You know, we have other big things happen, a hurricane that's supposed to hit the southwestern U.S. and a terrible tragedy in a limo accident that is gripping the attention of a lot of people. I do think, Ken, the bottom line is that we all learned a lot of lessons. We all experienced a spectrum of looking at ourselves and our country and what we believe in what we just came through.
You know something? I listened to what you just said, and yet there are still, in my view, there are still a lot of lessons that have not been learned, and no greater person am I thinking of right now than Christine Blasey Ford and the thought of the President of the United States openly mocking her at a rally. So I don't know what we've learned, but you, as you say, we do have elections coming up, and now we're going to hear from the people.
All right, let's leave it right there then for today, Ken, and we'll talk to you next Monday.
And no mention of dusky gopher frogs next week, okay? Because I think I've had my fill of the dusky.
Why don't you brush up on that case, and then you can about it as in expert detail. That is Ken Rudin, the political junkie. You can find more information and a link to his website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Coming up at 10 o'clock on Cap Radio, you're going to hear a live debate between the two candidates for governor in California, Democrat Gavin Newsom and Republican John Cox. The event is hosted by KQED. It will be moderated by political editor Scott Schaefer. And it's probably going to be the only face-off between the two candidates before Election Day, November 6th. Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler is joining me in the studio. Ben has followed the campaigns, talked to each of the candidates. So glad to have you with me today.
It's good to be back. It's a big day.
And you'll join us after the debate for some reaction and analysis. What are we expecting today?
It's a 59-minute radio debate, public radio only. There's no cameras, no TV. My understanding is that the Newsom campaign rejected having TV there. The two sides had squabbled over how to debate. Originally, Newsom proposed a CNN debate or agreed to a CNN debate. Cox did not agree to that one, but agreed to five others, some national, some local. Cox felt that it was important to have more debates and to not just have a national debate being the only one, because he wants the conversation to be about California issues, not about Washington and national political issues. And in the end, they ended up doing none of those TV debates. And kind of at the last minute, Newsom's camp threw out this this plan B, which is, the debate on Forum. Our colleagues at KQED have their talk show, and they had just put an ask in some months ago. And so Newsom agreed to that. Eventually Cox did too. And so in a state of 40 million people, where it's clear that in order to reach voters effectively, you need to be on TV, there's one debate only in the general election. It's at 10 a.m. on a Monday, and there's no TV.
I think that speaks to how, yes, there can be strategy in wanting to debate and debate often, but there can be a lot of strategy in saying no and in not debating.
Absolutely true. You saw last governor's race cycle 4 years ago, Jerry Brown agreed to one debate against then Republican candidate Neil Kashkari. It was right after Labor Day, so a month before now. It was a Thursday night for an hour or so, and that was the only debate. So you've got, look, this is California. Democratic candidates believe they have a significant edge here when running against Republican candidates statewide, particularly at this moment in time. And Newsom has a significant financial fundraising advantage over Cox. He has a lead in the polls, although there's evidence to support that maybe it's narrowed a little bit between the June primary and now. So I don't know how much it would be in Newsom's interest to agree to several debates. Those are ways the race's dynamics could change. He doesn't want it to. Cox needs the dynamics to change, or at least he needs to be able to get his message out to the 40 million Californians who likely haven't heard of him and might be wondering what he would do as governor, who he is. It's easy to not know much about him. So those are the dynamics at play here.
The debate will be heard throughout the public radio network in California. It will be picked up by other media as well. Today is a day that mail-in ballots go out in the state of California, so there is that element of timing, too.
It absolutely is joint timing, although I'm embarrassed to say, someone's pointed out to me on Twitter that because today is the Columbus Day holiday, there's no mail, that counties are not sending out vote-by-mail ballots until tomorrow.
Oh, typically, that's right.
I was wrong about that.
Oh, that's right.
I've been on the
no
air all morning
service.
Saying, you know, vote-by-mail ballots go out today.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, folks, but they do go out this week, and it reinforces the point that Election Day is no longer Election Day in California. It is Election Month, especially in Sacramento County, where every voter gets their ballot now in the mail, as well as a handful of other counties
other
around
counties.
California, including a couple others in our listening area, like Nevada County. Even if you don't, even if you're not one of those counties, I mean, a majority of Californians typically, especially in low turnout elections, vote by mail. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of Californians are getting their ballots now, weeks before Election Day itself.
You have talked recently to each of the candidates. We're going to hear the fuller conversations later in the week. But you offered, and I said yes, to a little clip of a question that you posed to both of them. So I don't know where you want to begin, but I'd like to hear a little bit from each.
Yeah, I ended my interview with each candidate, and I spoke with John Cox about a week and a half ago on his campaign bus, and I spoke with Gavin Newsom on Friday in his San Francisco campaign office. And I asked them both to wrap up the interview what the most important thing is that they can do to help each voter achieve his or her California dream. They actually both kind of didn't respond with one thing, a laundry list of things that they want to do. But I tried to capture in the clips we're going to hear just a little bit of their campaign themes. So we'll start with Newsom. And he talked about how he believes that early intervention is important. So universal preschool, as well as universal health care, and addressing the high cost of housing in California, you know, and he tried to weave that into his answer. So let's listen to him.
All of those things, I think, will inure to a sense of optimism and renewal. But it requires, I think, an approach of being much more courageous and bold in terms of how we address those issues. And that's the change that I'm offering the voters of California. I'm not arguing for the status quo. We're going to dive deep into these vexing issues, and we're committed to seeing real results in real time.
And John Cox, meanwhile, talked about how the definition of insanity is trying the same thing over and over again and hoping for a different result. This being a state that has been led by Democrats overwhelmingly and consistently over the last 8 years since Arnold Schwarzenegger left the governor's office. So let's listen to San Diego businessman and Republican candidate for governor, John Cox.
We can't keep doing the same things in our broken political system. So people ought to know when they're voting for me that I'm going to be a reformer and I'm going to work day one to try to change this electoral system so that we get one that more reflects the people as opposed to these interest groups and the negative politics that we've experienced.
So as KQED promoted the debate, which is coming up in about a half hour, you will hear it live on CAP Radio, they did acknowledge that from John Cox, there will be more about reducing that big footprint of government, and from Gavin Newsom, more about families and children. I wonder if some of the big picture, for example, are they going to be asked about the Kavanaugh nomination and confirmation process? Are they going to be asked about the Trump administration? Will they be taken out of the capsule of California politics and government and look at the bigger country position?
So John Cox does not want to talk about the president, about the Supreme Court, about Washington issues. He wants to talk about California issues. And it's easy to see why. He is the Republican candidate for governor in a state that, by a 2-1 margin, repudiated President Trump in the 2016 election and voted for Hillary Clinton. It's a state where Republicans, registered Republicans, are at last check below a quarter of the electorate. Democrats are about, you know, low to mid 40s in terms of voter registration. High number, however, of no party preference voters. That there are more voters registered without party preference than are Republicans right now. And so Cox knows that if he is going to have a chance in this race, he needs to win over independents and some Democrats as well. There's nothing in it for him to talk about what's going on in Washington. Newsom, meanwhile, does speak a lot about what's happening in Washington and does speak about the president and does speak regularly about how he will fight to protect California values, as he puts it. And so you can see how there is, you know, that area is more fertile ground for one campaign than the other. Cox's point is like, look, we're running to be governor of California. There are a lot of issues in California. It's incredibly expensive to live here. You got gas taxes going up. You've got electricity costs going up, water costs going up. We know housing costs are very high. And so why should I be talking about Washington? We should be talking about fixing California. So he's going to try to pivot with that message if the national debate ever comes up. I should say I asked him when we sat down his position on Kavanaugh a couple of different times, a couple of different ways. He did not take that position.
Well, again, the debate, the conversation style debate, I think we'll call it, is going to be guided by political editor Scott Schaefer. Ben, you stay around. We're going to bring you back for reaction and analysis. And again, the debate is from 10 to 11 this morning. You'll hear it live on Cap Radio.
And if I could add a couple of additional quick plugs, Chris Nichols, our PolitiFact California reporter, and I just did a Facebook Live previewing the debate, and it's got about another half hour of shelf life. So go spend 7 minutes of the next half hour taking a look. And also, I'll be live tweeting the debate at AdlerBen.
Okay. Chris will join us at 11, as well as the national PolitiFact editor, Angie Holan. Thanks again, Ben. We'll
You're
see
welcome.
You in a little bit this morning. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation process, when those two women confronted and yelled at Senator Jeff Flake with the open elevator door, some people characterized it as a powerful process-changing moment. To some, it was awkward, maybe even cringeworthy. And again, in the process, in different ways, that moment when Judge Kavanaugh exhibited tears in his testimony to some people emphasized the point and his personal truth. For others, emphasized the point that this is an awkward process that should not be this way. I bring all this up because a Sacramento author, Melissa Dahl, who is also senior editor at New York Magazine's The Cut, she leads the health and psychology coverage, has been working on the subject of awkwardness. And her new book is titled Cringeworthy. And though when she came in here today, this was not meant to be a political conversation, I think many moments over the past weeks fit right into the discussion. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
Are you game for the direction that I just took this topic?
I am definitely game. It's all anyone can think about lately. So
your book approaches this as our sense of our tribal self. Mm-hmm. When are we awkward? What's happening in our brain? What do we perceive with everybody else? But I think our awkwardness and confusion was really on national display recently.
Absolutely. I mean, the moment you mentioned in the elevator, you know, I mean, these moments of awkwardness are kind of like they're moments of social disruption where something doesn't go as we thought it would, you know. And I became so interested in these moments. They're kind of secretly pretty profound, actually. You know, we sense when these things deviate from the norm. And what do we do with that discomfort when these moments happen?
When you say what do we do, another good example is when the president was at the rally and began mocking Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, and you freeze frame the shot and see all the different reactions of the people behind. Mm-hmm. Where some cheered, some looked stunned, some were unsure.
What do I do?
You really get the whole spectrum. So what made you focus yourself on awkwardness?
Well, so, I mean, I have a joke in the book that I've kind of been unofficially studying it for about 30 years. But
I'm not sure you have more claim to it based on your examples than anybody else. But okay, I get it.
I know. So I've been covering health and psychology as a journalist for the past decade or so. And something I've always loved about the job is anytime I'm curious about some aspect of human behavior, I can kind of go to the science and see what people have uncovered. And there wasn't kind of a grand theory of awkwardness to be immediately found in the literature. And so I kind of went to create my own. I was just so curious about these moments that make us uncomfortable, that are so common. And what do they say about us? What do they say about how we're perceived? And what do we do with those feelings? So those were the questions I tried to answer.
I mentioned that tribal aspect, mm-hmm. and I think that's so fascinating in the beginning that there are studies describing how people are before they know what they look like.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes. You're talking about, I came across this report from an anthropologist back in the late 60s, early 70s, he went to Papua New Guinea, to this really remote area where he was pretty sure the folks there had never seen what they looked like. You know, there were no mirrors, there were no cameras. The waters where they lived were kind of too shady for them to really get a glimpse of their reflection. And so for better or for worse, he decided to change that. And he came with a photographer and he brought them cameras, video cameras, tape recorders, mirrors. And he wrote down the reactions and published it years later. And he used language like they cowered, they covered, they crouched, they covered their mouths, they ducked their heads. And their reaction just to me sounded like what I do, you know, when I cringe at myself, you know, when I kind of get a glimpse of what I must look like to somebody else. And when it doesn't quite match up to the version of myself I had in my head. So that was one of the things where I thought these moments are secretly profound. They kind of speak to our identity and our place in the world.
But now American culture in particular, but other cultures as well, have gone very far the other way with selfies and social media and how much we want to put some of that on exhibit. And in a way, it's also airing out awkwardness and cringeworthy yeah. moments. We're documenting them and examining them differently.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, a show like Curb Your Enthusiasm came back last year, which is one of the most cringeworthy things in pop culture. It is something that I think we're all pretty interested in right now.
Do you have an event coming up here in Sacramento?
I sure do. Yes. So I went to Sac State. I graduated in 2007, and I will be speaking there tomorrow about my book, about kind of the writing process, about things that make me cringe at 3 p.m. I need to double check the location. Maybe you have that.
I don't have it right in front of me, but yes, 3
okay.
p.m. tomorrow at Sac State.
Yes.
We will have that on our website
Great.
As well. I'm talking with Melissa Dahl. She is senior editor at New York Magazine's The Cut. She has been talking about her health and psychology coverage. Her new book is titled Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. So let's advance it farther to where you took this theory and what you came to believe after focusing so much on this uncomfortable experience of being human.
Yeah. So I really think that these moments kind of they allow us to look at ourselves from someone else's point of view. There's this psychologist, Philippe Rochat at Emory, who calls these moments illuminates the irreconcilable gap is what he calls them. And it kind of shows the distance between the version of yourself you think you're showing to the world and the version of the world is actually seeing. And so to me, what you can do with that is maybe take that information in. I mean, we're always telling kids and, you know, people like, oh, doesn't matter what people think of you, but it does. It matters to all of us and it should matter. I mean, we should care what people think of us. Sometimes that's important to kind of correct our behavior and become the version of ourselves we wish we were. So
what's your conclusion about awkward silence?
Well, I think there are so many different ways that you can kind of weaponize awkwardness in a way. Awkward silences. I had this friend of mine who works at a big newspaper who had a boss who was famous for if someone came in, you know, asking for a raise or asking for a promotion, he would just sit there and there would be silence. And the joke was that by the end, you know, people would just like do anything to break the silence. And they would say, oh, never mind. I'll take a pay cut. I'll take a demotion. But I think if you can kind of, you know, withstand the silence, you can sometimes use that, you know, you can use that uncomfortable feeling to make a point or, you know, I mean, my therapist does it all the time, you know, to make me be a little more forthcoming. So if you can find a way to become more comfortable with it, it's interesting to see what happens.
What have you learned to do with your own experience of awkwardness? And I'm asking that question about you in particular, but also for all of us to learn.
So one of the most important things personally that I took away from this book that I use all the time, you know, I'm a pretty self-conscious person. I'm a pretty, you know, probably socially anxious person. And folks who study self-consciousness specifically in sports, this was kind of an interesting field to draw from, say that focusing on yourself, you know, like a golfer or something, that'll make them kind of screw. I don't know anything about sports, but it'll make them screw up, you know, on their putt or whatever. And so what they say is it's important to get them to focus on anything but themselves, anything but the minute, you know, things their body are doing or whatever. And for me, my kind of translation of that has been to when I'm here talking about my book, I'm not focusing on myself. I'm trying to focus on these messages that I think are important. You know, the key is to focus on anything but yourself, and then that self-conscious aspect should go away.
So do you have a little trick that gets you out of yourself or out of your head quickly?
I mean, for this specifically, it's kind of doing the work beforehand, you know, and making sure like, I want to get this message across. And that's what I'm focusing on. I'm not focusing on myself and, you know, how many times I've said like in the last 15 minutes. But
and with that, you gave me a very good note, and I will read it, that yes, in fact, you are speaking at 3 p.m. tomorrow at Sac State. It is at the Harper Alumni Center at Sac State. So there's the location. I want to add that there is brain science and biochemistry research, and you did look at how our body responds in a way that we can't control when some part of our brain says, we're in one of those moments.
Yeah. So specifically, I went to Germany, and I found these two researchers who I swear have to be the only people in the world who are as obsessed with this subject as me, but they specifically study, they're neuroscientists, and they study secondhand embarrassment, and they wanted to know what happens in the brain when you see someone else embarrass themselves or you see some other kind of cringeworthy experience happen. And what they found is the area of your brain that kind of becomes active is the same area that has to do with empathy. Like people who are really highly empathetic tend to experience secondhand embarrassment more strongly. So that just kind of was such an endearing fact to me, that people who feel this more strongly, people who, you know, can't watch Curb Your Enthusiasm or can't watch, you know, back in the day, American Idol editions or something like that. It's because you feel this connection to somebody else and you feel it as if it's happening to you. It's a really compassionate feeling. It can be.
Didn't you write about that you were dating someone who couldn't watch the bad auditions on American Idol because there was just such a visceral reaction
for
him?
He would have to get up and leave the room. He would just be like, oh, I can't do it. So,
Well, let me circle back around to where we started this, which was what's happened over the last couple weeks. And a very common phrase now, especially in younger generations, is that awkward and kind of announcing when we're in a cringeworthy moment. Do you think we learned anything over the last couple weeks about how we behave and how we behave in front of each other and on very big stages?
I hope one thing that I hope that maybe my book can contribute, and I hope maybe something we are learning in the last couple of years, is that sometimes it's okay to make it weird. Sometimes it's okay to be disruptive. Sometimes it's okay to make a scene. There are times when you should follow the social norms, and there are times to disrupt them. And, you know, those women in the elevator, they did not follow social cues, and they had some really powerful words to say. They made it kind of weird for Jeff Flake, and I'm so glad they did. And I hope more of us can be brave enough to make things awkward sometimes.
Melissa, when you're back in town, please stop by again. There are so many aspects of the work that you could do that we could have interesting conversations about.
I'd love to, yeah.
And Melissa Dahl's book is Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. She will be at the Harper Alumni Center at Sac State tomorrow at 3 p.m. And she is an editor and writer at New York Magazine. You can find her work there. Again, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
This is Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. The legendary portrait photographer Dwayne Michaels has an exhibit at the Crocker Art Museum through January. It is one of the first comprehensive overviews of his portrait style since he began his work in the 1960s. The photographer was in Sacramento over the weekend for an event at the Crocker, but he has joined us this morning to discuss his life and his career. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I'm so glad you are here.
Yeah.
Who was the first for you?
Who are we talking about?
I thought I could be provocative and throw that question out at you, and you would have fun with it because of all the people in your life. So, of course, I mean, the first portrait.
I went to Russia when I was 26. And I borrowed a camera. I was not a photographer. And I learned how to say in Russian, I hope, Mozhno fotografiya ti, which I think means may I take your picture. And I was a novelty item, and I would say that, and people would stop and smile. And I'd never do it in New York. I'd get killed. But no, it was very exciting. But I wasn't thinking of myself as a photographer. I was on a trip, you know.
So thank you in Russian, I think, is spasiba. So yeah. Did they say thank you? Did they appreciate that you were?
They went upside my head. No. I was 26. I'm 86. Do the math. So, you know, I had hair and I was cute and I was hitting on Russians. They didn't even know it. literally. And they were literally hitting me back.
Your exhibit at the Crocker includes 100 portraits, which I can only imagine is a sliver. Do you have any idea how many portraits in this 50-plus years you've done?
Lebendy-leben.
No,
I don't know. Portraits were sort of the staple, but I've done a lot of other things of photography. But I love doing portraits, but I never applied the pretensions of capturing anybody. That's such nonsense. I knew my mother and my father my entire lifetime, and not once did they reveal themselves to me. Mm. So I don't think 5 minutes in front of a camera, you know, when people put on their portrait face. People have portrait faces. They, you know, the minute they see a camera, that smile and the whole thing happens automatically. There's no revelation. There's just a moment of shared moment, but I didn't reveal anything.
You didn't feel any special depth or any special view into a person?
No, never, no. I don't have I have no depth at all. I'm very shallow. So
you've mastered cute at 86, though. Can I tell you that?
No, I love taking portraits, but I have no pretensions that I've revealed anything or somebody makes a sort of a weird look. You know, they sort of blink and that's not revelation. That's just a blink. You know.
I'm pausing and thinking about some of the images in this beautiful book that the Crocker did. By the way, what do you think of this compilation of your work?
Oh, I think it's terrific. Are you kidding? I'm my biggest fan. I love it. Who took what masked man took those pictures? Yeah, I haven't worked in 60 years because my definition of success is you find something you love doing and you get somebody to pay you to do it. So I take pictures for free and just because I love it.
I didn't mark the page, but I glanced through it and saw a portrait of Joel Gray.
Oh, yeah, he's an old friend.
That stopped and caught me.
Yeah. I just spoke to him the other day. He's one of the few people I know in the business, yeah.
So does the moment that you captured in the picture, for example, say something different to you than knowing him now, the moment when you see him now?
You don't see that much. When you look at somebody, you really don't see that much. I don't really believe anything's revealed. There was a picture that I thought was dynamite taken by Alfred Eisenstadt in 1938 in one of the Reichsgardens with Dr. Goebbels, that wonderful comedian. And it was Eisenstadt was very Semitic looking, was taking a picture of Goebbels. Goebbels was sitting in a lawn chair, and he gripping the arms of the chair. And I think if he could have gotten up, he would have strangled Eisenstadt on the spot. I mean, there was such hatred in his eyes. There was absolutely no doubt that that was pure hatred on view, you know. I thought that was very powerful. But it doesn't happen very often because people put on their pose face. There's a picture you have in the back of your head taken maybe 10 years ago where you thought you looked good. And so you try to duplicate that picture, you know. People always automatically smile the minute you lift a camera. And when you put it down, they stop smiling, you know.
We're somewhat overlapping the conversation I just had about awkwardness and cringeworthiness and how we see ourselves versus what we see when we're shown ourselves
from
the outside.
Don't discount vanity. It's the driving force at all. When we look at anything, it's all seen through the filter of vanity. And as one gets older, you know, where did all my hair go? Long time falling. Anyway, tell me to stop. But
I don't want to. And I want you to add on some conversation about handwriting. Your work is about the photos and what you write and about the copy, too.
Well, you know, it's not just about photography. My key word is expression. How well do you express yourself? And sometimes photographs fail constantly. And then I could show you a picture of a woman, and what do you know? Well, she looks to be about 35, you know. But what does it, you know, is she nice? Is, you know, what do you see in a photograph? Nothing. Because the biggest scoundrels will smile their teeth out. I mean, you know, you cannot tell anything. Look at politicians. You ever seen anybody not smiling into the camera? And there's El Dumbo, Dumbo Trump, but that, smile. Anyway, you know, I don't believe it. It's all facades. I did one photograph, if I may interject. It's in the book of my mother. And it's just, I was back in McKeesport, where I'm from, visiting after my father died. And she was sitting there looking out the window, and there was moisture on the window. And the moisture was catching the sunlight, and you could see her reflection. And she looked very, very sad, and she was tapping her fingers. And it was mostly the back of her head and that reflection. And I found it very touching because you could see her loneliness, you could see time on her hands, you could see that residue of age, you know, leftover time. And I found that very touching.
You were born in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, as you said, and I'm thinking about what you said earlier about your parents. How is it that we can go through our whole lives with our parents and feel like we don't know them?
Yeah, I don't know if you ever really can, and I don't think you can be your best friend. I don't want my dad to be my best friend. Certainly not my dad to be my best friend, but. There's that huge need for touching, a huge need for empathy, a huge need of sharing. It's a human thing. And I don't think you can make it happen. You have to permit it to happen.
You're listening to the legendary photographer Duane Michaels. He's in from New York, and a rare exhibition of 100 of his images just opened at the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento. It will be there through January. His work belongs to a number of permanent collections in the U.S. and abroad. That includes the Israel Museum in Jerusalem and the J. Paul Getty Museum. Of course, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Do people everywhere know you still for that group of 9 photographs from 1972? Things Are Queer?
No, I'm mostly known for my porn. My porn name is Ziggy Duane. I just made it all up. I make everything.
Do you have any YouTubes? No,
I have a lot of fun.
Are you all on Instagram, right?
Yeah, I don't do Instagram, actually. It's too quick, too instant. Ah. I'm laid back.
Are you a selfie guy?
No. I'm not selfish at all. I'm very generous. I'm sorry. I make these peculiar connections with language constantly.
That's good, but... Your handwriting opens this book. You have a quote.
Yeah.
Have you had your handwriting analyzed?
Oh, no. I should be. Not my handwriting. No, I love handwriting. You know, that's a bad quote. I don't know why that got in there. But I love, it's another form of touching. Handwriting is touching. And now that I discovered they're not teaching cursive writing in schools anymore, I can't believe it. I'm appalled.
Isn't that something?
Writing is fundamental to civilization, the basic thing. We became civilized when we began to write on walls and things. And not to be able to write, and it's outrageous.
So your writing is in cursive throughout the book. And if that's not your favorite quote...
It's not.
Which is...
Don't read it. I hate it.
Don't read it. All right.
The quote is, if you're standing too close. I forget the rest of it.
I like you a lot, so I'll honor what you asked. I won't read it. I promise.
Don't tell anybody.
How much are you still working?
Oh, constantly. I'm making movies now. I'm 86 going on 12. No, really. And I'm doing so much.
Has your mom been sharp in her age? Because your brain is so bright.
Yeah. No, it was the alcohol. No. She was sharpish.
Okay.
And then I was involved with my great friend Fred for 57 years, and he finally left me because of Alzheimer's. Hmm. And that went on for 7 years. But he used to say very funny things at one point. I love contradiction. And I won't say what he said because it's too dirty for public television.
When you are next in Sacramento, will you come back in again? I have so enjoyed meeting you.
Yeah, I'm a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
I'll attest to that. Dwayne Michaels' portraits exhibit at the Crocker Museum in Sacramento continues into January. You can find more details, but I don't think anything on the website will capture the delight of this man in person. Yeah. Thank you.
See
again.
Bye.
That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our executive producer is Joe Barr.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.